We the voices behind the faith of the Hawaiian nation, the Hawaiian race, rise for justice, the day has come for all our people to stand as one. E ala e, e ala e. We the voices behind the face, the Hawaiian nation, Hawaiian race, rise for justice, the day has come for all our people to stand as one. E ala e.
Aloha, everyone. This is KP here from KP Radio Hawaii. We're speaking in the afternoon of October 10th on the 10-10. And we have a special guest today. In fact, you're my first guest on the program.
Oh, good.
And so this
well,
is... Yes, this is Ali'i Mana'onui, Lani A. Sinkin, and Lani, I wondered if first you could introduce yourself. I think a lot of people would be interested in how, what the title of, what your title means, and how you receive that title, Ali'i Mana'onui.
Well, the Ali'i were the high caste in Hawaii in pre-contact times. Actually, if you go deeper into the history of Hawaii, there were no caste systems until the Tahitians brought their caste system to the islands. And in that system that was brought by the Tahitians, the Ali'i were the ruling group, and they were responsible for oversight of everything within the islands. And then there were the commoners, the Maka'ainana, who were the people that actually worked the land and all
right.
of that.
Right.
And in the Ali'i system, the king or the high chief, there was no king then, but the high chief would be the one responsible for the overall well-being of all the people and for the relationship between the civilization and the gods. So the high chief had the responsibility of maintaining clear connections with the spiritual basis of the civilization.
Okay.
So this particular title, Ali'i Mana'onui, Mana'o means heartfelt thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
So if you and I are exchanging views, I'm sharing my Mana'o with you.
Yes.
So this was a position that was created by the last queen of the kingdom, Queen Liliuokalani.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a position that she created, which was designed to specifically provide her with someone that would always tell her the truth without any fear of retribution. So she as the ruler could rely on this person to say if she was out of line, if she'd made a mistake, or if she'd done something wrong, that person could say to the ruler, you goofed. And the ruler would say, thank you very much. That was the nature of the position. And really a very creative and necessary position when someone has a whole lot of power is having someone that can say to them, you made a mistake.
Yeah.
And they're promised to withhold any retribution or any punishment for speaking the truth was to give the freedom to that position to say what needed to be said. The queen was overthrown before she could actually fill that position. But the king today, Edmund Kaligi Silva, knew about the position. And when he and I started working together 8 or 9 years ago, he said he would like to appoint me to that position for him. So my sacred obligation to him is to be a trusted advisor and a friend and to speak bluntly to him if I think he's done something wrong or he's out of line or whatever. And he's supposed to accept that as, you know, he doesn't have to necessarily agree with me,
mm-hmm.
but he has to accept that that's what I have seen and I've shared with him. And then it's up to him as to what he does with it. And there's no blowback to me for having done that service to him. That's my job.
Yes. Well, I mentioned before that I feel that that's really to have someone respect you and honor your judgment, your mana'o in that degree is really I would expect you would feel quite honored by that appointment of that title.
Oh, clearly.
And why don't we first go into a brief history of you, of Lanny, of maybe you can give us a brief of your life, where you grew up, and your education. I know that you've participated in various arenas on planet Earth. So could you give us a little bit of your background?
Certainly, and I've been on the planet for 68 years, so it's too long a story to tell the whole story.
Oh, you just started.
I grew up in I grew up in San Antonio, Texas, and grew up in a very Jewish heritage, strong commitment to the Jewish principle of tzaddik, which means justice. So the obligation of a practicing Jew when I was being raised was to bring justice in this life. It's not about the afterlife. It's about doing the right thing in this life. And that also meant that if there was injustice being committed against others, an obligation to try and stop that injustice as well.
Mm-hmm.
I went to my first political rally when I was 10 years old. My father was very involved in politics, and my mother was too. They were both icons in the San Antonio community. My mother was here for 90 years. My father was here for 100 years. And when they left, the outpouring of respect and love for them was absolutely phenomenal. They had been of service to their community throughout their whole life. So that's the model that was set forth for me as I was growing up. And I was in the same footsteps in the sense of being politically active and fighting injustice. I was involved in organizing students for Kennedy Johnson when I was in high school. I coordinated an anti-war effort in Cambridge, Massachusetts in the 60s. I went on to do litigation. I became a lawyer. I spent 10 years in licensing hearings for nuclear power plants, trying to prevent that technology from spreading. I was a lawyer on a racketeering case against the private covert operation that was part of the Iran-Contra scandal. I filed suits on behalf of the whales against the U.S. Navy and their high-intensity sonar testing on the whales.
You mentioned one thing in your legal history, and that is you tried to get standing for cetaceans to bring suit without a human surrogate. Could you explain that a little bit?
What I was doing in that case was two things. This was a case in which the United States Navy had come to Hawaii to test low-frequency active sonar, very powerful sonar that happens to be in the same frequency range as whales calling to each other operate. And I filed suit to stop the testing on the whales. Ended up filing 5 different suits against the Navy during that period. And in one of those suits, I took on what was a rule of court that seemed to me to contradict a rule of law. So the law was the Endangered Species Act. And if you read that act, it's very clear that preventing extinction of any species was a very high priority in the act, and that everything should be done to prevent harm to species that were endangered.
Right.
When those cases came to court, the courts had developed a rule that said, well, even if the species is harmed, you still have to have a human harmed in order to bring suit. So there was a suit about crocodiles in Egypt being brought by people who studied them, and the court said, well, your connection to them is not strong enough for you to have standing to come into court, and we're not going to allow the crocodiles to be in court without the human surrogate. So the case was thrown out. I'd watched that case. And I'd also read a very powerful book that was called Should Trees Have Standing? And it was a book written by a law professor suggesting that natural systems should have standing to come into court without a human surrogate. So I brought suit. It was basically the cetacean community versus George Bush. And I was arguing to the court that the cetaceans, as endangered species, should have the right to be in court without having to be represented by some human who was also harmed by the same activity. The judge in Honolulu tossed out the case and took it up on appeal to the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco. When the opening arguments began, I went after the Navy about not having prepared an environmental impact statement for the use of this high-frequency sonar during threat and warfare conditions, and the judges stopped me and said they really wanted to focus first on the question of standing. And in an interesting development, the two of the judges were there. One of them was appearing by television from Nevada, where he was sitting on a case in Nevada. So the first question from the judges was, actually it was from the judge in Nevada. He said, "Mr. Simkin, are your clients in court today?" And I said, "No, Your Honor, but then neither are you. So maybe one day we'll have the technology where we can communicate with the whales and understand what they're trying to tell us about what we're doing on the planet." And everybody in the court cracked up. Everybody enjoyed the argument. We had a wonderful argument. The upshot of that case was that the judges ruled that it was up to Congress to give standing to animals. It wasn't something they could insert into the law. That, however, there was nothing in Article 3 of the United States Constitution that prohibited Congress from granting standing to animals. So they basically ruled Congress could go ahead and give standing to animals or to endangered species if they wanted to. There are other circuits in the United States where there have been cases in which animals have gotten standing. Loggerhead turtles in Florida got standing, and that case is still there. So that was what that was all about. It was a great joy for me to try and do that. To expand the protection for endangered species, to be representing the whales, and to try and change the law. It was all sort of a lawyer's dream for me.
Well, what period of time was that? I mean, we're talking about, you mentioned Bush. Is that Bush 1 or Bush 2?
That's Bush 2.
Bush 2.
So this is in the late 90s, early 80s.
Well, one of the things that I know, you know, there's a lot of people who'll be listening to this from Hawaii, and I know that one of the things that I remember, in fact, I think it's probably the first time I read your name in the paper, was the super ferry that a corporation was trying to bring over here, which, you know, many people really thought that was a great idea. I've ridden on ferries before in San Francisco and all this and all that. Can you just briefly tell us a little bit about what the problem or what the challenges were that?
I'd be happy to. And sure. I should note that I got a call, I got a call 3 days ago from a television reporter in Hawaii saying that candidates running for office right now, are talking about bringing Super Ferry back. And did I have any thoughts about that? And I shared my thoughts about that.
Uh-huh.
But this was the first time around where the Super Ferry Corporation came to Hawaii, and Governor Linda Lingle and her director of the department responsible for oversight of the Super Ferry basically waived the environmental laws for Super Ferry and did not require an environmental impact statement. So there was a very strong legal challenge brought against Super Ferry on potential harm that could be caused by the operation of the ferry. And a number of harms were identified, and included in those were that this is a high-speed boat, catamaran, operating at very high speeds, moving through the grounds where the whales give birth. So there was a potential for a strike on the whales. That was one. We also have a terrible problem in Hawaii with invasive species. But different islands have different problems. So on one island, you may have a mongoose, on another island, you don't. On one island, you may have fountain grass, and on another island, you don't. One of the concerns was that this super ferry, because it would be carrying the automobiles of the people getting on in one island and getting off in the other, might well be a vector, a transmission corridor, for an invasive species to move from one island to another. So that was another major concern.
Right.
There were different things that came along. One judge ultimately ruled that there was irreparable environmental harm that the super ferry could cause. The case did go to the Supreme Court in Hawaii, and the Supreme Court in Hawaii said that the Governor Lingle and her administration had made a mistake and that the Super Ferry did have to prepare an environmental impact statement. It was at that point that I actually got involved in litigation, because what happened was Governor Lingle said, well, I'm going to put the Super Ferry into operation. And she sent the Super Ferry out to go to Kauai. And when it got to Kauai, people on surfboards had built a barrier of surfboards across the opening of the harbor, and the ship could not get in. And the Coast Guard was accompanying the ship, and the Coast Guard was totally frustrated. They could not break the barrier. They behaved in a very poor fashion, uncovering their 50 caliber machine guns on their boat as if they were going to shoot somebody to get the boat in. But the boat turned around and went back. Governor Lingle then mobilized federal, state, and local law enforcement, including the Coast Guard, got the Coast Guard to create a security zone in the Kauai Harbor, where if anybody went into that zone without permission, it would be 10 years in jail and a $50,000 fine. And the Super Ferry was then protected in its illegal operation by Governor Lingle's multi-agency task force law enforcement group. And I sued particularly the Coast Guard and said that they were using a national security law to protect an illegal private operation, that the Super Ferry was operating illegally because of the Supreme Court ruling. And the upshot of that case was that the court at the Honolulu level said that the Coast Guard had followed their procedures as required by the Administrative Procedures Act in adopting the security zone, so it was okay. They did not address the issue of whether Super Ferry was operating illegally. I took that on appeal to the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit panel started their opinion by saying that we alleged that the Super Ferry was operating illegally and the Coast Guard was protecting it and that was not right, and then wrote an opinion that never came back to the issue of whether Super Ferry was operating legally or not. So in both courts, our key issue was never addressed. But the cases were thrown out. But meanwhile, the Super Ferry had basically been stopped. The judge in Maui issued an injunction preventing them from coming into Maui. And they could not earn any returns. And they went bankrupt. Actually, they'd been losing money the whole time. Very expensive to operate. So they went bankrupt and they went out of business. Another theme of all of that was that this boat was actually a test run for a company that was trying to sell these boats to the military for landing, getting troops close to land. And that this was all basically a covert military operation of testing this high-speed boat for something that would lead to a multi-billion dollar contract with the United States Navy. That's what was really going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, and for those listeners who do not know, there's a small presence of military here on the islands. There has been for quite some time, but
there's a massive military occupation of the Kingdom of Hawaii by the United States government.
Yes, yes. Well, how about we do this? Let me ask you this. What, I think people would be really interested in knowing, what brought you to Hawaii? What happened to you to where you realized that you had a connection to Hawaii?
This goes back to when I was in Washington, D.C., working at an interface law and public policy center called the Christic Institute. And that was where we were pursuing a racketeering case against the private covert operation that was part of the Iran-Contra scandal. Another case that I worked on there was the Florida Peace and Justice Coalition came to us and said that NASA was going to be launching a deep space probe to Jupiter, the Galileo mission, and that the onboard power supply for the Galileo mission was 50 pounds of plutonium, and the decay heat from the plutonium would keep the equipment warm as it traveled and be used to generate electricity in deep space to operate the Galileo mission once it arrived at Jupiter.
Mm-hmm.
And the Florida Peace and Justice Coalition felt that the 50 pounds of plutonium on a space shuttle, we'd already lost one by this time, was an undue risk and they should not be subject to it, and they asked us to litigate the issue. So we filed suit to stop the launch of the Galileo mission and went through rapid fire through various courts in the federal system before they were able to actually take off. Now, sometime during that case, I was approached by a whistleblower who said that there were computers that came through his company on the way to NASA, and he was required to test them. In those tests, they failed sometimes and passed sometimes. He wanted to flunk the whole bunch and send them back to production. His management overrode his decision and said, let them go on to NASA, and we will get a repair contract when they figure out that they're broken. And this is how the game is played, apparently.
Right.
And those were the computers on the shuttle with the 50 pounds of plutonium.
Oh.
Well, the way we dealt with this was that the Christic Institute was founded by a group of Jesuits and others who had been very involved in the Karen Silkwood case. This was a case about plutonium coming out of Kern McGee. And in that case, they got to know a private investigator who was one of the top private investigators in the country. He was a good friend of the director of security at NASA. So we sent word through our general counsel, Dan Sheehan, to the head of to this private investigator who sent it on to the head of security at NASA. And the next thing we knew, there was a stand down of the launch, and they were taking all the computers off of the space shuttle and replacing them with another brand. And I always felt like that whistleblower may well have prevented a disaster.
Yes.
And some years later, after I'd left the Christic Institute and moved out to Portland, Oregon, the whistleblower called me from Hawaii. And he said they were planning to build a space launch facility on the island of Hawaii. And there was a whole lot of opposition over there. It was mainly on the risk to the island, the conditions of where they were building it, all these kinds of objections locally based. But he also felt that people should be aware that this might well be a plan to move these plutonium launches off the mainland, where our litigation had made them very controversial. We got a ton of publicity when we challenged Galileo and people learned about these plutonium launches, that moving them off the mainland and over to Hawaii, to the island of Hawaii, where there were 125,000 people and nobody could hear them complaining, was maybe the ultimate plan. And would I please come to Hawaii and testify to the County Council of Hawaii? And at the time, I'd been in Portland for a couple of years, and I had not taken the bar, so I couldn't practice law, and I was basically penniless. And I said to him, you know, I haven't got two nickels to rub together, so I can't really come to Hawaii. So the next day, there was a message on my telephone from a woman with a foreign accent saying, your ticket's been bought, you're on the plane tomorrow, you'll come here for 2 days, and then we'll fly you back home. So I said, hey, you know, trip to Hawaii.
I love that. Up.
And so I got on the plane. I flew over, I got off the plane in Hilo, and my whole body started to vibrate. And I had never had that experience before, and I didn't know what it meant, but I intuitively knew it meant something really special. So I walked into the terminal, and there was the whistleblower, there was the woman from the Netherlands who had left the message, and her elderly companion that she had been with for many years. I spent 2.5 days there, and flew back to Portland and packed up and moved. And I knew I had been called to be in the islands. I didn't know exactly why. Well, it unfolded over the years why I was called to be there, all the preparation time. I eventually married the woman that I had met in the airport. We opened a spiritual center in Hilo called the Lightworker Center.
Mm-hmm.
We operated that for 3 years, morning, noon, and night. We had teachers and healers from all over the world that came to that center to offer classes and workshops. I got trained in 100 different disciplines just because I was coordinating it there all the time. And it was all preparation for where we are now. I know that now, but I was being prepared to serve in this capacity to help restore the Kingdom of Hawaii.
Well, That's pretty amazing. I mean, I was when I first saw that in the documents you wrote. And by the way, I will be posting this along with this interview, so people can read what you've a little more detail about your history and your connection to the islands. So it's very clear that you had. Did you ever get the sense that perhaps you've lived here before, or was that any part of your decision to come here?
Yeah. it was not necessarily part of my decision to come. That was a very quick decision.
Yeah.
But I did have very much the sense that I had come home when I got off the airplane. And I've heard this from so many people that have flown into Hawaii and just, you know, burst into tears when they got off the plane or whatever, feeling like they had come home. For me, as I went through all the workshops at the Lightworker Center and got doors opened, it became clear that I was in the islands at the time of Lemuria, when they weren't actually islands, they were part of a continent before the continent fell. And that I had been there many, many times over the ensuing years and had many different responsibilities at the different times I was there. And that now was the time for a light worker center, not just our little center in Hilo, but the islands themselves to be fully what they are, because the world needs them to be fully what they are. And it's up to us to restore what was and integrate the new that we've understood in order to be ready to deal with the entire world, which is going to be coming to our door.
Well, I think that's, you know, that's, I'm sure that people, many people listening to that can totally relate to that, because, you know, in my own case and many other people, I've seen people come here, visit, and they would step on the lava and they just break down in tears.
Right.
They knew they were here before. And so I really appreciate you sharing that with us. And stay tuned for part two coming up tomorrow at 7 p.m. Hawaii Standard Time.
What the land that she can give, defend up her right to be free, give our children liberty.